by that method would be connected to a wired telephone. Let me drop. So way back in the late 60s, ham radio operators driving around in their mobile automobile, transmitting touch tones through their FM transmitter into the local repeater, which in turn would then be commanded to connect to the telephone. The telephone would then ring the telephone at his wife's house, and so while he's driving around in his automobile, by way of that repeater and phone patch, he's now talking to his wife. That really was the first step toward cell phone. In many cases, the hams did it first. The broadcast world, way back in 1920, was using the frequencies between 0.5 and 1.5 megacycles, 200 meters. And the hams were given all those higher frequencies that were considered useless. And Mr. Clinton DeSoto wrote a book called 200 Meters and Down, where the hams using the lower wavelengths than 200 meters, the higher frequencies, like 80, 40, 20, 15, 10 meters, suddenly discovered there's something out there called ionosphere, and much, much longer communication, and these so-called useful frequencies were suddenly found to be very, very useful. So in many cases, these great things that the population is using, the hams did it first. Over to you for any comments on that one, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Well, Dick, one of the things I find amazing is it wasn't that long ago that we were doing that in the cars and phone patching. And look at the amount of equipment you had to have in the automobile. It all fits into something smaller than a pack of cigarettes today. Don't you find that amazing? Back to you, Dick.
In a way, I do, John. The very first repeater, the very first computers filled up a room. I was doing the equivalent of word processing using an IBM 1620 computer, which filled up a room at Pratt Institute, 1964. I was using the key punch to make up a whole bunch of these cards. The cards contained my resume. A few of the cards would contain the address of the company I'm sending a resume to. I would put that stack of cards into that key punch reader. The key punch reader was connected to a typewriter. The typewriter would type out the letter. Each individual company that got a resume from me when I was applying for a job, let me drop. Each one of those each one of those companies got a letter from me, which was on a high-class piece of paper. I was buying a very heavy bond, as I remember. And they could easily look at the letter and see the individual indentations of the striking of the typewriter keys. And they said, hey, this guy is serious. He's not just mimeographing things and making multiple copies. He really is typing an individual letter to us. This guy really wants to work here. I sent out 125 of those letters done on that machine. But that computer filled up a room. Nowadays, a computer of equal stealth and speed is a $5 calculator that we put into our vest pocket. So computers have gotten extremely small. Yes, the two-way radio has gotten extremely small, but we're very easily forgetting about the fact that this simple little radio in your hand is only 3% of that system. If you look at the amount of hardware that's at each and every one of those cell sites, and they're spaced every 4 or 5 miles, you have a huge amount of hardware infrastructure that's supporting the operation of that simple little thing in your hand. That simple thing in your hand is only 3% of that system, so to speak. Let me drop. And you very rapidly, in the case of Superstorm Sandy, where the power goes out, the batteries go dead at the cell site, your cell phone in your hand goes dead, and you suddenly realize that there's a hell of a lot of infrastructure there. Even though you ran around the neighborhood and you found some way of charging your cell phone, and now you intended to make phone calls, but the cell site was dead. There's a huge amount of hardware, extremely expensive hardware, at each one of those cell sites. That's where the rubber really meets the road, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
WB2BXO with a comment.
Station recognized.
Go right ahead, sir.
getting it from the tablet with no problem. I love that story about your early word processing with the using the 1620 computer. I teach a class on job search on Monday mornings, and I think I'm going to tell that story in the morning. Thanks.
Yeah, when I graduated from Pratt Institute with my bachelor degree, 1964, which was one of the years in which the industry, the electrical engineering industry, was going through real hard times. It was one of the down periods. People were being laid off. Nobody was being hired. I graduated with 20 or 22 other electrical engineers. Most of them left that school, having been interviewed by various companies at the job placement center at the school, and many of those guys walked out of that school without a job. By way of me using that IBM 1620 as a word processor, the word hadn't even been invented yet. I just realized that this machine could do that kind of very fancy typing. Each one of those companies I sent a resume to got something that was nearly perfect, because the thing never made any mistakes, if you know what I mean. There were no rub-outs required. Ordinarily, you type out a letter in 1964, and you're going to make quite a few mistakes. And if they look carefully at that, they're going to see places where you used whiteout and typed over the mistakes, or you had to put the paper in the machine five times in a row to finally get it right. So each one of those companies got what they thought was a very carefully written resume. Let me drop it. Very carefully written resume. They could see the indentations in the paper, knowing that it was really typed on that particular piece of paper. It wasn't a mass-produced thing. Turns out it was, but they didn't know it. And the net result of all that was I sent out 125 resumes, and in return, I got 6 job offers at a time when many of my fellow students with higher grade point averages than me walked out of the building without a job. And the particular company that finally hired me with the highest salary, the best sounding job, was Airborne Instruments Laboratory. That was a company that never even went to that school to interview the students. They didn't even know the school existed, so to speak. After I was working for AIL for a couple of years, I found out that the Human Resources Department started sending representatives to that school. They thought, that school turns out some pretty good electrical engineers. Yes and no. There are exceptions to the rule, but yes. I was doing word processing. I think I was doing it approximately 10 years before the word was invented, if you know what I mean. So, any other questions on that, Frank? WB2BXO. By the way, that computer filled up a room. I'll admit that the key punch machine didn't quite fill up a room. It was half the size of a refrigerator. And the machine that read the key punch cards, let me drop it. The machine that read the IBM punch cards and then ran the typewriter from it, that was also half the size of a refrigerator. But the general computer that backed up that whole system, it filled up a whole room. And we've come a long way. And that computer in those days, I don't know, but I'm guessing it had a clock rate of around 2 megahertz. Nowadays, the computers that you and I can put on our desktop run at 2.5 gigahertz of clock rate, and there's 3 simultaneous microprocessors in there all cranking away at once. We've only moved ahead 1 billion to 1, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Frank. WB2PXO, K2RIW.
KD2CBV with a comment.
Yeah, the tablet I'm holding in my hand, the Samsung Tab 3, talking to you through what probably has a clock rate in that range. Never mind my laptop. Anyway, you probably know now that your return rate on resumes, by the way, was phenomenal for that era. The accepted return rate on resumes is about 1 interview per 100 resumes. It may be changing now that everything's been transformed. I should know that.
Frank, I'm sorry to say that the machine went into its mode that sounds like you're off frequency. Every so often it does that with IRLP. So, unfortunately, you gave us a whole lot of information that we could not hear. So, essentially, none of that came through, I'm sorry to say, Frank. But we're going to go back to you after you get a chance to reconnect. KD2CBB, I think it was, Charlie Bravo Bravo. Give me your name, sir, and your question or comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Thanks for that. You'll find that weirdo on Staten Island knows me, as well as my silent partner, Hanley, very well. It's Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Bravo Victor. It's Todd and Hanley, the silent partner. He's my guide dog. When you were talking about the IBM cards, I don't know if they were yet called Hollerith cards. And I got my start, I was only 11, on an IBM 1130 in the Bronx, because the computer guy took a shine to me, and I spent the summer learning under his tutelage. And took up the whole room. The reason I was on the IBM 1130 was because they went to a Western Digital, which was twice the size of a refrigerator. Okay, I don't remember the number of the Western Digital, but I do remember that IBM 1130 so very well, and my own disc, 12 inches. Oh, boy. Yeah. But those were called Hollerith cards, and I don't know if IBM had a different name, but I just wanted to put that little comment in there. Very enjoyable story, though. And good evening to John and everybody else. KD2CBV. East Village.
East Village. 5th Street. Okay, in New York City. The big city. Very fine, Todd. Is Halloran a man's name? Do you believe that was the last name of somebody who invented those IBM punch cards? What do you think, Todd?
No, it wasn't.
Go ahead and tell us, John.
Old punch system was a card. Remember who was the inventor of the system, and it was originally used here in large-based control of the immigrants that were coming in. That's how we kept track of them. And also went to what do they call it, the census. It was used at the census also.
Yeah, we've come a long way. But lots and lots of people think that that cell phone is really doing all the work. Little do they know that that's a small fraction, a couple of percent of the system, if you know what I mean. But what's really going on at the cell site with that 150-foot high antenna, $500,000 worth of hardware, all kinds of transmitters and receivers and fancy computers, and a global positioning satellite receiver system, to align the clocks to the nearest couple of nanoseconds. There's a hell of a lot of technology in one of those cell sites. That's what really makes it work. That, in turn, is connected with a huge network that does all kinds of fancy calculating to figure out where you're located, which cell site you're near now, because you're in a moving automobile, which cell site are you likely to be near in the next couple of minutes, when should the handoff between this cell site and that cell site take place, and what do you do to make all the timing come out right so that you don't drop the call and you're not missing words and syllables and whatever. There's a hell of a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes that the average guy, he makes the mistake of thinking, that that thing in his hand is the cell phone system. You start asking these kind of questions to the average guy on the street and you'll get some pretty strange answers. A fair number of them don't even know that it's a radio. They think it is a telephone. And they're only slightly mystified by the fact that there are no copper wires connected to it. It acts like a twisted pair in some respects, but there are no wires. But a fair number of them don't even know it's wireless hardware. And they have very little respect for the amount of system that's backing it up. Okay, let's see if Paul's ready to go. And you probably know that a fairly big announcement was made in the last week or so, Paul, about the first couple of picoseconds of the universe. WS2N, K2LIW and the TechNet. Go ahead, Paul.
This is WS2N. I did hear that report on National Public Radio. They had a good show with Ivor Plato. He's the mediator on that show. He interviewed all the people, and he had a couple of people on talking about that discovery. A couple of telescopes looking out in one direction for I think 5 straight years or something like that. And they picked up evidence of a gravity wave, and David said that this could be a Nobel Peace Prize possibility for this group. Got a few things here, Dick. I'll bring up. Let me drop it. Good net so far. I'm listening to a lot of good stories. Dick, I like that blue and red description of the wave. That was really good. In the future, not too near distant future, we're going to have a lot of telescopes. Talking about telescopes in space, we've got. You know, a lot up there now, Spitzer and Kepler and the Hubble Space Telescope and the solar ones, a lot of solar, SOHOs, and, you name it, ACE, looking at the sun, looking at stars, European Space Agency put up Gaia recently, looking at a million different stars, looking for planets. So this is going to be the wave of the future for the next, I guess, 10 or 20 years. There's another one that was just approved. It's a joint venture between NASA and the European Space Agency called the Solar Orbiter. And it's going to be staring at the sun. It'll be an elliptical orbit going very close to the sun, getting a... 0.23 AU, somewhere 50 less than 50 million miles to the sun, and then a distance further away. So it'll be elliptical. Let me drop it. And it'll be launched in 2017, but it's got an interesting orbit every time it goes around the sun. It'll be passing, not every time, but a lot of the orbits will be passing Venus, and instead of giving it a gravity assist, you know, to speed it up or slow it down, they're going to use Venus to change its inclination. So after many years of use, it'll eventually be in roughly a 30 degree inclination to the ecliptic. So it won't be in quite a exactly a polar solar orbit, but it'll be getting close to it. It'll be able to see pretty much the top of the sun and the bottom of the sun. Now, that really hasn't been done since the early 90s with Ulysses. Ulysses went into a complete 90-degree polar orbit. And to do that, drop it. They got the bright idea to send it out to Jupiter. When it was out in Jupiter, it did some tests of the planet Jupiter before it went into its main function of looking at the sun. And it used Jupiter to do a similar thing what Venus is going to be doing to a solar orbiter. And it changed its inclination completely 90 degrees to the ecliptic. So, it's been a long time since they've done this type of thing, and they'll be doing it over time. So, I mean, it's got a lot of equipment on board, a solar wind analyzer, heavy ion sensor, heliospheric imager, a lot of things built by NASA and with the European Space Agency. A lot of things, missions are like that. And, you know, ever since space station. A lot of collaboration is going on between countries. So, probably the next 10 to 20 years, you won't be able to count how many different observatories we'll have in space. I mean, right now we get the Chandra Space Telescope up there doing X-ray work. There's been a lot of them that have eventually failed. They've been up there for so many years. All these new ones are going to be replacing everything that's up there. And another one that's going to join the solar orbiter is something called Plato. And that'll be... Plato, of course, is another one of these acronyms. Planetary transits and oscillations of stars. And that's going to be very similar to a Kepler type of thing. It's got photometers meters on there looking at extrasolar planets. It'll be looking at all these different stars, like the red dwarfs, looking for very small planets going around those stars, very similar to our sun. And that's another one that's going to be launched. Plato will probably be going up like 10 years from now, because that's just been approved. And that's primarily a European Space Agency mission that will be launched from Kourou down in South America, French Guiana. And in fact, that's not a very big telescope. They won't need the Ariane 5. They'll use the smaller one. The Soyuz, which they buy from the Russians, and refurbished them, and then they launched like brand new rockets. Now they've been doing that many, many years now, probably the last 5 or 6 years. And this is WS2N, and I know you're a big Hubble fan. They just announced that they will keep the funding up as long as it keeps going. And there's belief now that it's running so good, they hope to keep it going up until 2018, or maybe even 1 year past that, which is an amazing accomplishment, considering it's been up for 23 years now. In those 23 years, it's had 5 different service missions going to the Hubble, rebuilding it, putting in new computers, new batteries, they even have new solar panels on that thing, upgrading the electronics, which actually picks up the pictures, different spectrometers in there. A lot of work over the years, over the decades. Now they expect to keep it going. At least 1 year after the James Webb Space Telescope is launched, they want to calibrate the two together. Take similar pictures, compare the two, and they'd love to have that capability for at least a year. Not to mention, even today, it's coming back with new and better pictures. As time went on, it became better. The equipment on board now is probably 10 or maybe even 100 times better than what it started off as. Certainly in the beginning when everything was all blurry, you might remember that. They used to make fun of it on a Jay Leno show, but it turned out to be the most advanced piece of equipment flying in space today. It's probably done more to further the knowledge of what goes on in the universe and all of the Earth above telescopes that I mentioned. That's flying in space. And one other mission not related to space telescopes is there's a mission going up this Tuesday, actually Wednesday, Kazakhstan time. You've got another launch of 3 people, including 1 American, aboard the Soyuz spacecraft that's going up to the International Space Station. Right now they have 3 people on board. They had 3 astronauts, 3 come back a couple weeks ago, and they will be bringing the crew back up to 6. They have 3 now, and it will be 6 again, and that'll stay like that, until May, when the 3 that's up there now will come back, and they have a system. They'll wait a couple of weeks, so they'll send another crew up. So most of the time, the International Space Station has six people on board. And that's pretty much it. We'll stick around for any questions. As usual, I can be reached at spacenetreport@gmail.com. If you have any questions, Vic, or anybody else, I'll be standing by. This is Paul for the space portion of the TechNet, WS2N.
When you talked about Walter Lewin and the red disk of energy, or red something or other, run that by again, what you were saying about Walter Lewin, one of my favorite physics teachers. And I'm very unhappy about the fact that he felt he had to retire from MIT. What a loss. Over to you, Paul.
I didn't mention Walter Lewin, Dick. Might have said something that sounded like his name.
But I heard that too.
But you said Lewin, and you said Red, and Red something or other, and Lewin. What were you talking about, Paul? Go ahead.
Red dwarf stars with planets going around. You know, this telescope is going to be looking for planets going around different stars. So I think I might have mentioned that. The idea, of course, is always to look for planets that are the same size of Earth and in a Goldilocks zone, but don't know where. I'm trying to remember what I probably said something that sounded like that back to you.
Dick, it sounded to me like he was talking about Walter Lewin's explanation that you gave with the red and blue waves. That's what I thought I heard.
I was wondering how in the world did Walter Lewin know to say that.
I know why I said.
Now you know what you said. Go ahead, Paul.
That was in the beginning. That was in the very beginning. I liked what you had said about the red and the blue waves, the planar waves coming towards you. I like that description. That's all I was commenting on the earlier part of the net. Back to you, sir.
Yeah, and Frank and others thought that they were getting us too far off the center to get into that kind of a discussion. As I see it, very few of the books that try to give you a picture of what a radio wave looks like as it moves through space, you can easily get a wrong impression. When we talk about a wavelength, there are a lot of people who think that if you could see the wave, it really is that size. That's not it at all. It's a sheet of energy that, if you're a good number of miles away, it's a completely flat sheet of energy. It's got a curvature to it. But the curvature is so slight, you can't see it. And as the distance gets further and further, the curvature gets, of course, less and less. It's really part of a sphere. From your point of view, it's a completely flat sheet of energy coming at you at the speed of light. You slow down the movie, and the positive sheets, I'm going to make them red, and the negative sheets, I'm going to make them blue, and they alternate, red, blue, and so on. And if you look at the spacing between a red and a blue, it's a half wave. If you look at the spacing between a red and the next red, it's a full wave. At 3.5 megacycles, those two red sheets are roughly 260 feet apart. It's a full wave. And so the wavelength that you measure really in space is in the direction of propagation. It's the spacing between the sheets. You go to a higher frequency, and the sheets move closer together. That's what happens. They're all moving at the speed of light, and you get the red and the blue waves, which makes the positive and negative half of the sine wave when it hits your antenna, when it drops. So sheets always move at the speed of light. You move the sheets closer and closer together. They're going to be hitting your antenna at shorter and shorter periods of time. And that's what generates the height of your frequency. When you go from 80 meters up to the 10 gigahertz band, those two two red sheets are now 1 inch apart instead of 265 feet apart. Ain't that crazy? The individual sheets at 10 gigs, the red and the blue sheets are half an inch apart, and the distance between two red sheets are 1 inch. That's the wavelength at 10 gigs. And so those sheets come at you real fast, so to speak, at 10 gigs. And I was always amazed that if the wavelength is 1 inch, and you transmit the signal 380 miles, as that guy did at Rodent, Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, and he sends that signal with a 3-foot dish up toward Long Island, and on my little 2-foot dish on the top of my 100 feet of tower, I picked up that signal 380 miles away. 380 miles, each A wavelength is 1 inch. Let me drop. I remember sitting there saying, how the hell can the signal go that far, that fast, in frequency, without getting tired? The total number of wavelengths between Cape Hatteras and my house, I can calculate that it's a great big number. How the hell can that many wavelengths of signal go that far and it doesn't get tired? That's what I said way back in, that event occurred, I think 1995, 1994. When one of the guys from the KGB was the name of the club, W2GTM in New Jersey, headed up this microwave club. They called themselves the KGB. And KGB was a misspelling, and it stands for Climbing Gigahertz Brethren. Because these guys would go on mountaintops with their 10 gig dishes. And so one of the KGB guys goes down to Rodent, North Carolina, having a vacation with his family, and he's renting a beachfront house, and he walks out of the back door of the house onto the beach, sets up the tripod with batteries, starts transmitting, and I'm hearing his signal. And because of the way 10 gigs can propagate when you're near seawater, let me drop. I think he was running 10 watts, and I'm running 200 milliwatts, but his signal was like 30 or 40 dB above my noise. He sounded like he's in my backyard, because of the super refraction phenomena. That signal going over the water was being bent downward, and it exactly followed Earth curvature. So even though he was roughly 30, let me think now, my radio horizon is 40 miles out, and he was 380 miles, so he is 8 times beyond my radio line of sight. That signal, you draw a diagram on a page and you say that signal could never get there. And the signal was 30 or 40 dB above noise. That signal was acting like it was a free space path and there was no Earth in between, if you know what I mean. Even though it was almost 10 times beyond Earth curvature. And on a couple of occasions, I've heard some reflection off of aircraft on 10 gigs. But the alignment's got to be just right. It's a very sharp effect. But at that time, in 92, 93, 94, whenever that occurred, I was amazed that the signal didn't get tired. And now, when you listen to Voyager, 127 astronomical units out, 3 times the distance of Pluto, and that signal at 8.5 gigahertz goes that distance, and it doesn't get tired. It's a beautiful example of what I've been saying for a long time. You transmit a radio signal, it goes to every cubic centimeter of this universe, and you can't stop it from doing that. In some of those places, it's going to be very weak, and it's going to be below the threshold of the equipment you're using at that time, but it's there. You can't make the signal disappear. You can't make it disappear with distance. You can't make it disappear with sheepery. You can knock it down 90 dB, 100 dB, with an extremely carefully constructed screen room. You can make it weaker, and with distance you can make it weaker, but it never stops. It never stops in time, it never stops in distance, it never stops by going to zero in signal strength. It's always there. All you've got to do is devise more and more sensitive equipment and you will get it at a greater and greater distance. You give enough money to NASA, and that Voyager will never run out of range. Maybe it's time for us to start collecting some private money to do that. What do you think, Paul? I'm being a little bit crazy here. WS2N, K2LAW.
I have a couple of questions about that, if I may. KD3CBB.
You know, the Deep Space Network has been upgraded over all these decades since that thing went up, so it's constantly being improved. In fact, they're building new antennas down in Canberra, in Australia, right now as we speak. So who knows? They might have more sensitive equipment. No matter how far that thing gets out, they'll, as long as it's transmitting, they'll be able to receive it. I mean, if they use the equipment that they had first started out with at the Deep Space Network, right now I don't even know if you'd be able to hear it, because the initial projection was that we might not be able to hear Voyager after, I think it was 2015, and now it's predicted to go all the way to 2025 or something.
It never stops. In fact, that signal is so enthusiastic, it can even get to East 5th Street. It can get into Todd's backyard. KD2CBV, K2LAW. Go ahead, Todd.
Yeah, I thank you for that. You know, I'm listening to what you're saying, and something occurred to me, but when you said that the signal keeps on going, you can drop below the threshold and all that, okay, fine. And I guess the only way you could stop it would be to absorb the signal at a certain point. But when you got to the point of explaining how, you know, they're 1 inch apart, because, you know, if you look at a wavelength on an oscilloscope, you see the sine wave, okay, fine and dandy. That's two-dimensional, and I'm looking at what you're saying, so to speak, and we tend to think of a radio wave like as a linear, like a laser beam. I'm trying to articulate this correctly. I want to make sure that I get it right. That's why I sound like, And I'm just wondering, when you talked about 1 inch apart in the plates or the sheets being 1 inch apart, that denotes that a radio wave is three-dimensional, and when you broadcast from your antenna, it's going in 360 degrees, it's going up, down, you know, and all that. So I'm wondering, does a radio wave actually have a physical shape? Because most of our references, the wavelength, how far apart, yada, 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 that's all a physical shape. But I'm wondering, as a whole, also, does it have a physical shape? It has to be 3D. And I'm just wondering about that. I might be a little off topic, but, you know, so that's the absorption thing and the shape of a radio wave. Thanks for letting me ask. KD2CBB.
Oh, you're right on target, Todd. It's a good question. And I've been there. I'm going to answer your question in reverse order. The shape first. I wrote an article describing the shape of a radio wave, if you could see it, in a slow motion movie. That article was presented and published on the website of the North Texas Microwave Society, the K5RMG, the Roadrunners Microwave Group, k5rmg.org, used to have this website with technical information. And the bottom of the technical information page was called the K2LAW Corner. And one of the 10 articles I had there exactly described the shape of the radio wave in three dimensions. Unfortunately, for reasons I don't understand, the K5RMG, the Roadrunners Microwave Group of North Texas, decided to eliminate their technical section. You can still get it by way of a Wayback file. There are places you can go to something called a Wayback file, and you can find out what used to be on a website. So you can get that article. And I'm not sure whether or not I've got a copy of it on my machine, because I got to reissue that one. Let me drop it. And in my description, I made a slow motion movie as a thought experiment, and you're watching the very first cycle of a wave coming off your dipole antenna. And it's a microwave dipole antenna where the dipole is kind of short, and you're sitting out there in space a good distance away from it. That first cycle, the red sheet of energy, comes out of the dipole as a bubble, and the bubble expands at the speed of light. It's like a soap bubble being blown up, if you know what I mean. And so you've got the first sheet is really a bubble going out in all directions at once. It's an expanding bubble. The very next cycle is the next bubble inside of it, a little bit smaller in diameter, also expanding, both at the speed of light. And the way I explained it is that the dipole has got a certain pattern. The dipole's got a pattern where broadside to the dipole is putting out a strong signal, and off the end of the dipole is putting out a weak signal. Let me drop. And the way I explain that is that the bubble is brighter in the areas where the signal is stronger. The bubble is very thin and dim off the ends of the dipole where it's very weak. It's almost as if there's a hole in the bubble in that area. So the brightness of the bubble is the antenna pattern. Every antenna you and I have ever built, ever used, ever looked at, ever described, ever seen, ever read about, all antennas put out a three-dimensional pattern. They all put out bubbles. As the antenna gets bigger and bigger in wavelengths, becomes higher and higher in directivity, and it eventually becomes a pencil beam antenna, very narrow in horizontal and vertical beam width, that just tells you the section of the bubble that's bright. But every antenna has got a certain front-to-back ratio, front-to-side ratio. It's radiating signals in every single direction at once. It has no choice, just that the signal is a lot brighter, a lot stronger in certain directions, depending on the antenna pattern. The antenna pattern really is brightness and dimness of those individual sheets of those bubbles that are expanding. Now, you can make another model of the antenna pattern. Let me drop. If you use an antenna plotting machine that uses a piece of polar graph paper, you're really taking a slice across the antenna. You rotate the antenna, you measure the signal strength in each direction, and you measure and you just plot that signal strength as the radius on the signal you're plotting onto that polar graph. And eventually you get this the thing that looks it looks like a slice through a cucumber. So you can describe the antenna signal strength as a deflection, and you can make a three-dimensional model, and it looks like a cucumber when you make a pencil beam antenna, and it's got a bunch of rings around the bottom of it, which represents the side lobes. So that's representing strength as a spacing, as a distance from center. But that's just a model to display the concept. But what's really happening is the antenna is always transmitting in all directions, and just certain areas of the bubble are brighter. That's the main lobe of the antenna, where the bubble is maximum brightness. That particular model that I'm now describing to you, let me drop, is my way of visualizing the real antenna and the real propagation, the real signal flowing in time. I have never seen that kind of a diagram in any respected textbook. You're getting a brand new piece of inside secret information, Todd. Make sure you don't tell anybody. KD2CBV, K2LAW in the tech net.
Wow, I like that. That actually makes sense. Good thing I have a hearing problem, so I can't repeat that, which I didn't hear. Now you know why I said that weird guy in Staten Island, it takes one to know one. But, okay, if it's expanding, is the expansion, because as we would say, we said three dimension, is that expansion a fourth dimension on there? It's not time, but which is usually the fourth dimension, but I mean, isn't the expansion also another measurement? You know, because it's constantly expanding. And then, don't worry, I'm not going to go on and on about it, but I'm just curious that, you know, the expansion has to be a measurement of some sort, I guess. Or is that not in the equation? I don't know. I don't know. That's why I'm asking the question. Duh. Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Bravo.
Don't worry, Tom. It's a good question. Yes, the expansion is another dimension. We know that all of these bubbles are expanding. In every direction, the radius is exactly the same of every bubble. The radius is moving to a greater radius at exactly the speed of light, 300 million meters per second. But this is a slow motion movie so that you and I can see it. All the bubbles are the exact same round shape, just that they're brighter in certain areas. We know the bubbles are expanding at exactly the speed of light. Therefore, you and I can calculate how fast the volume of each bubble is increasing. We can also calculate what is the area of each bubble. You calculate the area of each bubble, and you know exactly what the inverse square law is. It's a little bit like studying what happens if I've got a perfectly round white light bulb in the middle of a spherical room. Assuming the light bulb has got 100 watts of output, and if the area of the room, it's got the right radius, if the area of the room is 100 square meters, and the light bulb is an isotropic radiator in my example, we know that each square meter of that room is getting exactly one watt of light hitting it. It's conservation of energy here. You can't destroy that energy once you transmit it. So the 100-watt light bulb in a room with an area of 100 square meters, each square meter is getting exactly one watt. Double the diameter of the room, because it's a 4 pi r squared area thing, you're going to have 4 times the area of the room when you double the diameter, double the radius. Therefore, each square meter is now going to get 1/4 of a watt. You didn't lose the power. Let me drop. Everybody calls it free space loss. Every time you double the distance, you get 1/4 of the power. We call it free space loss. The words fit the equation that you're going to use on the paper, but there is no loss. Assuming you don't have lossy, foggy air in that room, if that light bulb is putting 100 watts out, I don't care if the room is big, small, long, short, high, 100 watts of energy coming out of the light bulb is going to be hitting the walls of that room, and if you add up all the energy on the walls of the room, it will be exactly 100 watts. That 20-watt transmitter on Voyager right now is smearing 20 watts of energy across those great big spherical bubbles in space. And a very tiny little bit of that bubble is hitting the Goldstone dish in California, and they're listening to it and writing down what it says, if you know what I mean. But that no energy is lost. Now, when it comes to how do I destroy a radio wave, and you said you could absorb it. Let me drop it. And you can decide to try to destroy the signal in this particular chunk of space. You can build the world's most perfect screen room with 100 decibels of shielding. The signal still goes into that screen room. You can't stop it from doing it. But the signal that gets into the screen room just happens to be 100 decibels weaker. That's not zero. It's damn weak, but it's not zero. It never goes to zero. And when you put up that chunk of absorbing material, anechoic material that you line the screen room with, that also absorbs the signal. But every piece of anechoic material has a rating as to how much absorption it does. Real good absorbing material absorbs the signal so that what gets reflected back off is 40 decibels weaker. Not infinite decibels weaker. The signal doesn't come back at zero strength. It comes back 40 dBs weaker. Every piece of anechoic material mankind has ever created has an echo. I have measured that echo. I got a great big award for doing that. I measured that echo off the anechoic material in the world's largest chamber at Edwards Air Force Base. Did that in 1989, 1990, that period of time. I measured the echo coming off the absorber material. So your absorbing material, let me drop it. Absorbing material is doing two things. It's creating an echo that's 40 dB weaker back in the direction where the signal came from, and some signal flows through the absorber, and what flows through the absorber is probably also about 40 decibels weaker. So no matter how hard you try, You can absorb the living daylight out of the signal. You can stop the reflection. You can knock the reflection down a whole lot of dBs, but you can never make it go to zero. Ain't that crazy, Todd? You got the right kind of instrumentation, and I did that. I can measure how much comes back. I can measure how much flows through. You can't stop it. You can make it weak as all hell, but you can't stop it. KD2, CBV, but you've never read that before. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay. That's the basis of how you see something. You know, if you see something that's black, it absorbs everything except black. Or if it's brown, it's everything except brown. Brown is reflective. You know, it's a similar analogy. And if you get a chance and you do find that article, if you could email it to John Casey, to WGB, I'd appreciate it, because then he'll be able to forward it to me. And the other thing I got to do is I got to find a rectangular light bulb and a square light bulb so I can get the lumens into those dark corners. Wait, I'm blind. All right, well, it was an idea. But no, I really do appreciate it, and it's not that crazy. Really, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Bravo Victor, East Village.
What you're now hearing, Todd, is you're hearing the individual details that make me say, you launch a radio wave, it goes to every cubic centimeter of this universe. You can't stop it from doing that. It goes everywhere. That's the magic of wireless. It's hard to believe that once you press down that key, once you push that push-to-talk button, you have created a radio wave, you've set into motion some electrons, some magnetic field, whatever. You have started an event that's going to go forever. It will never stop. And you did it. You created something that goes forever. Very few of us looked at it that way before. We're creating an infinite event. We're creating a bubble that very rapidly goes to near infinity in area and volume. It goes to near infinity in distance. The only thing left to discuss is how weak is it when it gets there, and how long is it going to take to get there. That signal coming from Voyager takes 17 hours one way at the speed of light to get here. You send a signal out, you turn on the transmitter at Goldstone in Mojave Desert in California at the, I can't think of the name of the Army base right now, where the Goldstone dish is located. I was there once. Okay, you turn on that transmitter, and you send out a signal to Voyager, and the nature of the signal is, hey, Voyager, what's happening? What's up? 17 hours later, the signal gets to Voyager, and if Voyager answered instantaneously, 17 hours later, 34 hours round-trip time, you get the answer back, yeah, I'm out here, it's fine. I'm getting a little lonely. It's getting kind of cold out here, and I'm out beyond, let me drop it. And Voyager says, I'm out beyond the major distance of the solar wind from the sun. I'm not seeing solar wind anymore. I'm starting to see galactic wind. I'm beyond the heliopause, I think it's called. It appears though I've left the solar system. Voyager is out of the building. Voyager has left the building. Is that what they used to say about them? Elvis Presley. Elvis has left the building. Voyager has left the solar system and has left the building. But he's still sending out those signals. And that nuclear power supply, hopefully it's going to hang in there to the year 2022 or 2024. And hopefully there'll be a TechNet 10 years from now. And Paul will be telling us how many astronomical units Voyager is out there. I think I told you guys, I made a rough calculation as to how strong is the signal that Voyager delivers to the 250-foot diameter dish at Goldstone, California. At that particular dish, the signal is around minus 153 dBm. One microvolt is minus 107 dBm, so it's almost 50 dB weaker than a microvolt. It's 100,000 times weaker in power than 1 microvolt is what you get out of a 250-foot diameter dish, which is around an acre of antenna. An acre of antenna collecting that signal, collecting those planar waves, the red and blue sheets of energy that are roughly an inch apart, because that dish, the Goldstone is running at X-band. Let me drop. So the sheets of energy hitting the Goldstone dish are roughly an inch apart, red ones and blue ones alternating, half inch between them, between the reds and the blues, 1 inch between the reds, the alternate reds. And you collect as much signal as you can with the Goldstone dish, and you've made that dish as accurate as you can, as efficient as you can. That dish doesn't even have a piece of transmission line going from the subreflector down to the low noise amplifier. It's so-called beam waveguide. In order to raise the efficiency there, it goes into a real good parametric amplifier that's probably running at something like 20 degrees Kelvin, real cryogenically cooled amplifier. And you end up with the signal 153 dB weaker than a milliwatt. That's a real weak signal. If you express that in zeros, it would go on forever, if you know what I mean. One with a whole lot of zeros. And out comes 150 bits per second of information telling you what that thing is seeing. That's one hell of a piece of hardware. So, Paul, what's the chances, Paul, that 10 years from now, Voyager is still doing its thing, and you're going to be on the TechNut telling me how many astronomical units Voyager is going to be? You're going to have to give us a rough estimate, Paul. How many astronomical units will Voyager be in the year 2024, 10 years from now? WS2N, hope we haven't put you to sleep with this. K2LIW in the TechNut.
Okay, well, 40,000 miles per hour, a little bit less than that. About 3 or 4, a little over 3, probably maybe 3.3 AU per year. So it'll be another 30, a little over 30 AU. So you're 127 now, you're going to be looking at, I call it 157 AU 10 years from now, Dick. So we can make that prediction. It's interesting what you said about the radio waves. When you transmit, you think of it going across town or across maybe to Hawaii or maybe a QSO to the moon or to the planets. But when I made up my QSL card, let me drop it. Years ago, I got a picture of a real picture of the Milky Way, Milky Way, that was taken by the COBE space telescope, and NASA had pictures. These are pictures that you can take any pictures that NASA puts out, and it's for public use. So I made up my QSL card like that. I probably sent you one years ago, Dick, but it's a picture of the Milky Way. And back then, I remember saying, I'm going to be transmitting my call. It was back, I don't know how many years ago that was when I made up those cards, because it's WS2N after I changed over from KB to BPV. I said, well, that's it. My signal is going to go all the way right across this whole galaxy. 100,000 years from now, it'll make it to the other side. Thank you, Dick.
Dick, it's only 520 technets away. You've got to mark that on the calendar. That's a good way of looking at it. This is TechNet number 1,499. We're about to, the speedometer is about to, the odometer is about to cross the big number. We're about to hit 1,500 next week. 1,499 is where I think we are right now. Boy. And this TechNet has been on the air more hours in its 31 years than Johnny Carson in his 30 years was on The Tonight Show. We put in more hours. We've topped Johnny Carson. We may have even challenged Johnny Carson plus Jay Leno combined. I'm not sure.